You're listening to a podcast from York City Church. If you like what you hear and you would like to find out more, please visit our website at www.yorkcitychurch.org.uk.
Good morning, everyone. It's really nice to be able to add my welcome to those of Mark and Hannah already. My name is Peter, and it's lovely to see you this morning. You join us in the middle of a series called Abraham, the Promise and the Pilgrimage, looking at 10 or 11 chapters from the first book of the Bible, the first book of the Old Testament of the Bible, which is called Genesis. And we're embarking again on this quite remarkable story of the man named Abram, later Abraham. And we've had a Sabbath Sunday break, so I thought I'd give us just a little bit of a recap. Might be a good point to recall some of the details of the story so far. So we started off in chapter 11 of Genesis, and the promises of God and the story of the God and the destiny of the people that God has called is somehow hit what we might call the metaphorical buffers with the Tower of Babel incident. And things look bleak. Humanity has been scattered, and it is at this moment we are introduced to the man Abram and his wife Sarah, who we learn had no child. And then at the start of chapter 12, a quite remarkable thing happens. God makes Abram a promise which will set the direction, really, I guess, underlies the 10 chapters that we're looking at through this series of the story. He says, I'll make of you a great nation. I'll bless you, and I'll make your name great, and you yourself will be a blessing. And then follows a series of scenes which I guess you could say the cast iron promise of God wrestles with the data on the ground that Sarah is old in years and she is barren, and the nearest thing that Abraham has to anything resembling an heir is his servant Eliezer of Damascus. And Abraham journeys through multiple lands, through Egypt in chapter 13. He rescues his hapless nephew Lot in chapter 14. In chapter 15, God restates his promise in the most dramatic nightly ritual you could ever imagine that John Healy preached on recently. In chapter 16, Abram takes matters into his own hands and has a child with his servant Hagar, and no end of problems result in that. In chapter 17, God again, a third time, restates the promise, this time with a renaming of Abram to Abraham and with the covenant sign of circumcision that was given. Then chapter 18 starts with a fourth restatement of the promise, this time with a deadline. This time next year, God says, you will have a child, you'll have a son. And then the end of the chapter and the rest of chapter 19 tells the strange story of Lot and the city of Sodom that Seb and Phil so wonderfully unpacked for us recently. And then at the point we arrive at today, we find ourselves in chapter 20 of Genesis. And Lynn is going to come and read the whole of chapter 20 to us.
From there, Abraham journeyed toward the territory of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur, and he sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife. Now, Abimelech had not approached her, so he said, Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not himself say to me, she is my sister? And she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this. Then God said to him in the dream, yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. So Abimelech rose early in this morning and called all his servants and told them all these things. And the men were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you did this thing?" Abraham said, "I did it because I thought, there is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, 'This is the kindness you must do me. At every place to which we come, say of me, he is my brother.'" Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you." To Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you, and before everyone you are vindicated." Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and also healed his wife and female slaves so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Okay, so reading this story, and as I was doing so and recalling earlier bits from the Abraham narrative, I was reminded of a mildly amusing episode which happened to me in my early 20s. Some of you may have heard this story before, so here's your opportunity to laugh at my foolishness for a second time. I once spent a weekend in Wrexham at a party reuniting with some school friends, and on the Sunday morning, we all headed off to the station, ready to go our separate ways. And it turned out I was the only one in the group who was taking the train north. Everyone else was heading south. And so I got on the train. I waved goodbye to my friends and should really have got ready to change trains in about 20 minutes' time at Chester. Instead, I fell asleep. The train terminated in Chester, I presume, I don't know, because I was asleep. I presume everyone got off, and then the train started up again in the opposite direction, changed into a Birmingham-bound train, and returned along the line heading south, first stop, Wrexham. I woke up at exactly the moment the train arrived in Wrexham, and the carriage rolled into the station, and my sleepy face lined up perfectly with my group of friends who I'd said goodbye to about 40 minutes before. You can ask Beth, she was there, that's a true story. It's a very disorienting experience returning to a place you think you've left and seeing reality repeat itself or a similar pattern of events play out. But this seems to happen to Abraham a number of times, and indeed happens in the biblical narrative throughout particularly the Old Testament and into the New rather a lot. If you know your biblical onions, you may have spotted a number of stories going along the way in the Old Testament which happen at different times and in different places, but with very similar features. Possibly the one that is most commented on is the scene of a betrothal at a well. Rebecca and Abraham's servant who is looking for a wife for Isaac, Jacob and Rachel, Moses and Zipporah. In each of those three stories in the Old Testament, a man journeys to a foreign land, sits by a well, asks a woman for a drink, and a betrothal of marriage is the result. And interestingly, in John chapter 4, there is a similar but different story of Jesus meeting the Samaritan woman by the well. Or we could think of similar repetitions in announcement of births and think about the story of Hannah, the mother of Samuel, and Mary, the mother of Jesus. They each receive from an angel the promise of a child. They respond by calling themselves maidservants of the Lord. Then they conceive, they give birth. They sing a song of praise to a God who is turning the tables on the mighty, and then they present their child at the temple. Do you see that in both of those stories, there's a very similar set of events, even though the scenarios are quite difference. In fact, we saw one in the last couple of weeks. Lot and the men surrounding the house in Sodom happens in very, very similar, almost identical fashion between the Levite and the concubine and the men surrounding the houses in Gibeah in Judges 19. It's a very similar scenario, repeating itself again and again. And we could point to the New Testament and things like the feeding of the 5,000 and the fact that in the book of Mark, that is then followed a couple of chapters later by the feeding of the 4,000. Similar but different stories. And in Genesis chapter 20, we have another example of such repetition, because a very similar scenario happened to Abraham in chapter 12. Abraham went down to a foreign land. In this case, it was Egypt, not Gerar. And because he feared the people killing him to obtain Sarah, his wife, he passes her off as his sister. The king, Pharaoh, finds out, confronts him angrily, but somehow, and you're not quite sure how this happens, Abraham emerges sent away with riches and blessing. And perhaps more incredibly, the whole episode happens again in chapter 26 of Genesis between Isaac and this king in our chapter, Abimelech. It's confusing, isn't it? All these repetitions. Isaac passes Rebekah off as his sister to Abimelech again. Abimelech at this point must have wished he'd never met the Abraham family. And he emerges from the whole thing again, blessed with riches. This strange repeating pattern. Repetition is important to spot when you're reading the Bible, whether it's a repeated word that is used or a repeated set of scenarios. It's a bit like getting a Bible and taking a highlighter pen to various bits. It's a way that the authors were able to draw your attention to certain pieces of the text. But what's surprising about this story in chapter 20 is actually how different it is to the one in chapter 12 with Pharaoh. The scholars will tell you it's written in a very different style of language. Eloist in this chapter versus Yahwist in chapter 12. For those who understand those things, that doesn't include me. In chapter 12, we have the facts, the scenario. The scene plays out, then it resolves and we move on. In chapter 20, it's a very psychological story. It's about motivations. It's about accusing and asking, why did you do this and how did you bring yourself to do what you did? Why did you act in the way that you did? And we're presented with three dialogues, and we're going to focus and structure ourselves today around these three dialogues and tease out some of those structures. And the first dialogue is between Abimelech and God. The word actually for God used in this section is Elohim. So firstly, this dialogue, Abimelech and God. Abraham lies to Abimelech about Sarah being his sister, and Abimelech sent and he took Sarah. And then God comes to him in a dream and says, behold, you're a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife. Now, I'd venture that of all the phrases you probably don't want to hear from God's lips, this ranks up there. It seems the cuddly Santa in the sky of popular mythology has a Reservoir Dogs-esque edge to him. You're a dead man. And then the dialogue continues. Now, Abimelech had not approached her. So he said, Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did not he himself say to me, she is my sister? And she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and in the innocence of my hands, I have done this. Now, that a heathen king is worthy of an address by the Lord is probably quite surprising within the context of Genesis. But Abimelech and God then embark on a full-blown conversation. And that is very unusual in Old Testament narrative. See, God often speaks indirectly through messengers or prophets or dreams or angels or priests. He sometimes speaks directly to those who he has chosen, like Abraham or Noah or David. It does happen, but it's quite infrequent that he speaks directly in his own voice, so to speak, to an outsider. to a heathen king, one who actually poses a threat to his promise to Abraham and Sarah. And Abimelech is bold towards God. He explains his actions. He may be objectively guilty because what he's done is he's invited Sarah into his harem, but there is nuance in this, and God is attuned to the nuance. Abimelech has not approached Sarah. That is, she's not been made his concubine. And he's been deceived. He thought she was a free woman because of Abraham's lie. He's innocent, he protests, and he has acted, the phrase used, in the integrity of his heart. The narrator here interestingly uses this phrase, integrity of his heart. It's been used, actually, of Abraham in chapter 17, and it's also used of Job. You may know the biblical character Job, who is described as blameless and upright, the same phrase used here. So this is not actually a mocking phrase. This is actually meant to in some way symbolize, this is what God is really saying, the integrity of his heart. Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that you've done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he's a prophet, so that he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you don't return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So God accepts Abimelech's innocence, using the same word, integrity of your heart. He reveals that it is he who has in fact kept Abimelech from sin, and he assures him he'll come to no harm if he returns Sarah. In all of this, it's really striking, isn't it, how God is acting here, how God himself comes across. And I think we can give ourselves license to find it a bit strange and to live in that strangeness for a season. You see, from one perspective, maybe this is just me, from one perspective, God appears to wade into the situation entirely unbriefed, almost sort of stumbling into the room, seeing something he doesn't like, misreading the situation, throwing his weight around, making death threats, and then really quickly backtracking and climbing swiftly up when he hears the explanation that Abraham has been up to his old sister wife, oops, trick again. What is going on? Why is God presented in this way? How do you respond to a God who acts in this manner? What thoughts does it raise for you? Is God here as you would expect him to be? Reflecting on that this week, I've been musing on how glorious it is that the God-human relationship is an interactional relationship, just like a human-human relationship is. But unlike human-human relationships, one party holds all of the cards. One party has all the knowledge and all the insights and all the wisdom, and it can only be that way, can't it? It's inherent in who God is, and it's inherent in who humans are. You're one side of the relationship, you have the controlling narrator of the universe's story. On the other, you have a 35-year-old man who sometimes sits for a full 5 minutes staring at his cupboard, working out which shirt to put on in the morning. It's an unbalanced relationship. There's a balance there that's out of kilter with knowledge and insight and wisdom and who holds the cards. And this could make God a tin pot dictator, couldn't it? A micromanager, barking out orders at every turn, every minuscule human action controlled. But it doesn't. Stories like this remind us that God may hold all the cards, but he doesn't always decide to play them straight away. In his strange wisdom, he often plays dumb. He often acts in peculiar, sometimes gruff, sometimes unreasonable ways. Sometimes hiding his knowledge, sometimes seeming austere, sometimes pretending to take a position that he does not truly hold, in order and all to the end to draw out of us a truer response, a more honest reply than we would otherwise have given, a franker of assessment of what is happening on the inside. He's often working in these peculiar ways to shake us from cozy drift, to incite a reaction from us, to almost shake us and get a bit of response, to tease out our truest thoughts, to niggle at us until we reveal our deepest workings, acting in some ways like a friend with an agenda, even if at the end of the process he self-evidently retains his place as the all-knowing master and Lord. He does it here to Abimelech, and one day he may do it to you. Don't imagine God's disposition to you will always be immediately affable, breezy friendliness. He takes you far too seriously for that. He is not humoring you. He takes you very, very seriously. And thus the way he presents himself to you may not always feel cozy, comfy, cuddly. He's looking to bring out of you a true response. He's looking to connect with you and to bring from you depth that you perhaps didn't know, and to move you into greater realities of truth in your journey with him, greater maturity and Christ-likeness in him. And he may take a strange approach to doing so. And he may not appear the way you want him to appear, but he knows you better than you know yourself. And he takes you seriously. Don't respond by flipping out or by checking out. Don't respond by backing off. Press in. When he comes to you with perhaps a frowning countenance, as the hymn says, know that behind it is a smiling face, but know that the frown is for a reason. The frown may be for your goodness, your godliness, your maturity in him. The second dialogue starts with Abimelech now confronting Abraham. So we've had God confront Abimelech. Abimelech now confronts Abraham. He rose early in the morning, and he called all his servants and told them all these things. And the men were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? How have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You've done to me things that ought not to be done." And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you did this thing?" This second dialogue is all about the ironic contrast between Abimelech and Abraham. You see, remember, Abimelech is a pagan king. He's no history or experience of the things of God. He's not part of the lineage, and he won't appear in the Hebrews' list of great faithful ones of the faith. He's not expected to play the part of a hero. He's expected here to be the arrogant, haughty, foreign king who is an enemy and is in opposition. At the very least, we might think he might have been tempted to consider what happened last night as just a dream, maybe to put it down to too much cheese or to write off the meeting with God as a figment of his imagination. But the text paints a short but very vivid picture. In response to God, Abimelech arises early in the morning, gathers his servants, tells them of the words of God, and great fear comes on them all. God has, in a manner akin to other places in this story, God has tested Abimelech, and he has responded appropriately. And now his questions and accusations can be turned on Abraham. So this contrast is really interesting. We see this one side, this pagan king who was not expected to be acting in the manner which he did. And then we see the other side. Abraham said, "I did it because I thought there's no fear of God at all in this place, and they'll kill me because of my wife. Besides, I mean, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, this is the kindness you must do to me. At every place to which we come, say of me, he's my brother. Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah his wife to him. And Abimelech said, behold, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you. Ironically, Abimelech, pagan king, feared God and acted with integrity, while Abraham, promise bearer and father of the faith, feared the people and acted with dishonesty. Not just once, but twice. Not just on a whim, on a premeditated plan concocted by him and using Sarah as his foil. I guess there was a hint of truth in it, of course. She was his half-sister. But that's a poor excuse, really. I think when a pagan king is inviting Sarah into his bedroom, it's the wife bit which is important. And worse, this half-truth is Abraham's way of using Sarah to save his own skin, which is hardly an honourable way to behave. As one commentator puts it, the one most directly called to faith and fear of God is the one who models faithlessness and fearfulness of man. So how do we interpret the actions of Abraham and of Abimelech here? This is the key bit of the chapter, this contrast between the two. How do we interpret them? How do we learn lessons which we can, I guess, transpose into a different key for our life in God in 21st century York? Let's note again the contrasts. Abimelech and Abraham. We have integrity when it comes to Abimelech, contrasted with dishonesty for Abraham. And we have fear of God for Abimelech, contrasted for Abraham with fear of people. And there are a variety of ways you can interpret this contrast, but one way is the difference between works and faith. The works of Abimelech were integrity. The works of Abraham were dishonesty. The faith of Abimelech was expressed through right response to God, fear and trembling at the sense of God's otherness and his bigness. And the faith of Abraham, well, is fear of people. It's not real faith. There are different ways that you could use that framework to suit your theological persuasion. So Martin Luther, the 16th century founder, I guess, of the Reformation or starter of the Reformation, would have emphasized the contrast between the life of Abraham at times, his failures, and the faith of Abraham. And then he'd make the point that his faith alone is the determining factor in the blessing and the salvation that he receives. And that would be a very Reformation way to think of this. I guess Catholic and maybe perhaps Jewish scholars would emphasize the concordance between the life of Abraham and the faith of Abraham, for the fact that Abraham leaves his land in obedience to God in chapter 12. And then the Apostle Paul in Romans 4 offers a whole masterclass on the relationship between faith and works through the story of Abraham. It would take a theologian above my pay grade and with significantly more time to unpack that chapter. But perhaps that would be some after-sermon homework to read Romans 4, Abraham, faith and works. But what is interesting in this passage and what I want to highlight through this is that here we don't seem to have Abraham saved and blessed by either faith or works. He has neither, but he's still blessed. The promise seems to be the strongest element of this. Neither his faith nor his works are the determining factor, because the attention is meant to be drawn, our eyes are meant to be following and going towards the promise. And in fact, even beyond that, to the promise maker. Abraham is justified and vindicated by God's faithfulness and God's work. And this should direct our hearts as we navigate issues of faith and belief and works and actions. I know these things are all key things sometimes in the life of Christians. And even those, if you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, as you think about faith, is faith based on a thought, a feeling, something inside, or something I do, a set of works? These questions rise their head. But this chapter seems to suggest that Abraham has neither and yet still finds himself in the place of blessing. You see, your faith is not an abstract concept. It's not a feeling or a preference or a compulsion within you. It is a faith, or it should be a faith in faithfulness, and opting to believe in someone who possesses a faithfulness you do not. A tapping into a faithfulness which is not your own faithfulness. We surely recognize the frailty in that. But instead is the faithfulness of Jesus, the obedient one who went to the cross and fulfilled all the promises of God. And then your works are also not abstract categories, you know, a collection of good deeds or good choices or good actions that come out of you. They are the outworking of Christ in you, the work of the worker, the one who has achieved the greatest, fullest, and most final of works on the cross and in the resurrection. Your faith matters less than who you have faith in. Your works matter less than he who works in you. Don't let your attention be drawn to subjective feelings of faith or objective good deeds. Those things have their place, but they flow out of the faithfulness of the Messiah Jesus, the one who is the only one to be obedient to the end, the one who's the only one whose works are sufficient to fulfill all the promises of God, whose works are sufficient to raise us to new life in him. If this story teaches us anything, is that Abraham is finding himself in the promise maker, not in his own strength. And now we turn to Sarah. Abimelech says to her, "Behold, I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It's a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you, and before everyone you are vindicated." And the same principles seem to be shot through this section. The underlying message is yet again God's faithfulness to his promise. By bringing Abraham through the mess of his sin and Sarah into safety, protection, and preservation. In fact, preservation is underlying this short verse. Several clues to the idea of preservation here. This phrase, "a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all," is actually, it's better translated as a legal term, a covering of the eyes. It's a legal term for protection. And then this phrase, Abimelech says, "your brother." Well, we all know that's not quite true, but it's actually there because Abimelech is again using a term of protection. And then 1,000 pieces of silver, which is not so much about the material amount, but is about the fact that they have confirmation from Abimelech. "You may go and dwell in my land. You have a gift. You have been honored. You are favored. You are safe in this particular place. You have safe passage through Gerar." This all points to God's unswerving commitment to preserve the future mother and father of the divine promise. God has chosen the risky path of locating his plan, the way forward from darkness into light, in the midst of the messy, dirty lives of these two humans. Their destinies, decisions, and choices carry forward the promise. And his graciousness is displayed in the way he doesn't just wrest the story from them like a frustrated parent, "Oh, just give me that." But instead, he finds ingenious ways of turning narratives which threaten to impel the promise into narratives which confirm even more how strong the promise is. He preserves Abraham and Sarah, which preserves Isaac, which preserves Jacob, which preserves the 12 sons, which preserves the line of Judah, which preserves David, which preserves Jesus, which, since we are all now heirs of the promise, according to Christ, means he preserves us too. There's an incredible preservation of his promise in this chapter, which reaches and stretches even down to York in 2019. Let's finish by looking at the third dialogue between Abraham and God. In verse 7, God had told Abimelech, Abraham is a prophet, so he will pray for you, and you shall live. Well, Abraham is a prophet, as well as being a mixed bag, to say nonetheless. And in this theological context, being a prophet meant really being an intercessor, interceding between two poles. So Abraham does pray for Abimelech, and he does live, which in some way proves Abraham's prophetic calling. And something else too. Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, and also healed his wife and female slaves, so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. We must not miss the profound nature of the last sentence of this. Their wombs were closed because of Sarah. This whole story, since chapter 11, it's sort of about Sarah's closed womb, isn't it? And so this literary device in chapter 20 keeps the narrative on a knife edge. Sarah was barren in chapter 11, and now 9 chapters, 6 countries, 4 promises from God, 2 covenant ceremonies later, and all that's happened is now everyone else is barren too. Can you see how the writer is taking us to the edge of despair? He's almost willing for us to take the book and just hurl it across the room and say, look, when will the promise be fulfilled? It couldn't get any bleaker. It couldn't be more unfulfilled. She's 90 years old, for goodness sake. At the end of chapter 20, we couldn't get any further from the promise. Until that is the next verse. Chapter 21. The Lord visited Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did to Sarah as he had spoken. And Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the time of which God had spoken to him. Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore him, Isaac. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh over me. And she said, Who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. Sarah speaks some words we've all said or will say at some point in one way or another here. She speaks and voices that moment when the doubt and the anxiety and the worry we all inhabit instantly evaporate on contact with the fulfillment of God's promise, the sudden resolution of God's appearing. Sarah says, who would have said? Who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Who would have said that God would come through and provide? And maybe you will one day say, who would have said? Who would have said? Maybe you already have. Who would have said that month by month, God would provide when the bank balance just doesn't add up? Who would have said that despite your despair, your circumstances, God would give you the strength to weather the storm of unemployment or sickness or bereavement? Who would have said that God would give us the citadel? Who would have said that God would fill this place with worshippers? Who would have said, the Lord, that's who? The Lord said it in chapter 12, and he said it in chapter 17, and in chapter 15, and in chapter 18, and then in chapter 1, the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did to Sarah as he had spoken. The promise has been preserved through 9 chapters of mess and chaos. The promise has been preserved and kept secure through 6 countries of chaos and war and destruction. The promise has been preserved through 2 covenant ceremonies marking out the people of God. The promise is being preserved through 4 promises and visions from God. And now the time is right for it to be fulfilled. I end on a quote from G.K. Chesterton. It's always simple to fall. There are an infinity of angles at which one falls, only one at which one stands. Thus the heavenly chariot flies, thundering through the ages. Dull heresies lay sprawling and prostrate. And still, the wild truth is reeling, but standing unconquered. At the end of chapter 20, the wild truth is reeling, but still standing unconquered. Blessed are you, sovereign God, ruler and judge of all. To you be praise and glory forever. In the darkness of this age that is passing away, may the light of your promise, which the saints enjoy, surround our steps as we journey on. May we reflect your glory this day and so be made ready to see your face in the heavenly city where night shall be no more. Blessed be God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. That is the end of our meeting this morning. The last thing to say is that tonight, 7:45, we have a prayer meeting. Come, pray, believe in the God of the promise who preserves it, and we'll see you either tonight or the same time next week.